claws extended, with Little Mouse's fate hanging in the balance. Chapter 49. Spire Albion, Havel Landing Shipyards, AMS Predator. Gwendolyn opened her eyes and regretted it almost at once. She had never drunk wine or other spirits to excess, though she had seen the effect it had produced in any number of House Lancaster's armsmen after various holiday celebrations. She had always found their winces and green faces somewhat amusing. She suspected she would have more sympathy for them in the future. The light did not merely hurt her eyes, it stabbed it with rotted, rusty old swords. Her heartbeat sent pulses of pain through her skull and down her neck as if on wires, and for the life of her, it was everything she could do not to simply roll to one side and commence evacuating the contents of her stomach. Wait a moment. Had she become drunk? The last thing she remembered was the mad old etherealist singing sadistically unfortunate lyrics to a truly disgusting aeronaut's song, and then... and then, an enormous surface creature? Though surely that was an artifact of the feverish barrage of nightmares she'd endured for she knew not how long. Perhaps this was simply a hangover. If so, she had some apology notes to write to Esterbrook and his men. She found herself letting out a groan, and that hurt as well, on top of everything else, as if sudden fingers of fire had dug into her ribs and her back. She put a hand to the pain, and found that it met with something a little rough and tight. She had to open her eyes to see what. Bandages. Beneath a rather thin shift, her torso had been wound with bandages until they were almost uncomfortably tight. She had been injured then, while drinking. God in heaven, please no. Benedict would never let her hear the end of it. She lifted a hand to her aching head and found more bandages there, for goodness sake. Her head pounded in steady time. A head injury? Ah, then. Perhaps she hadn't humiliated herself after all. Perhaps she'd simply had her wits scrambled by a blow of some kind. That settled, she turned her eyes to the room she was in. Wood. All wood. Walls, floor, and ceiling. One wall was slightly curved. She was most likely aboard an airship then, which would make the wall a bulkhead, and the floor a deck, and the ceiling a... well, she wasn't sure what ceilings were called on airships. Ceilings, she supposed. There was another occupant in the room, a man she didn't know, from his dress, one of the sailors aboard Predator. He was armed with sword and gauntlet, but he was currently sitting in his chair and snoring heavily. There were bags under his eyes. The poor man looked utterly exhausted, and one of his legs was dressed with a bandage. One of the men wounded in the first Auroran attack, perhaps? Poor fellow. He was doubtless there to guard her and make sure she didn't get out of bed without speaking to some sort of physician who wasn't there anyway, so there seemed to be no real sense in waking him. And besides, she was barely clothed. Gwen sat up slowly. Her head spun wildly for a moment and then settled down again. There was a pitcher and a mug on a nearby table that proved to be water. She drank three mugs down, hardly stopping to breathe, and in a few moments felt nearly human. Gwen found her clothing lying in a heap nearby. It was stained with... goodness, what was that horrible purplish colour? And they smelled absolutely hideous. She winced with distaste, put them down, except for her gauntlet, and began to rummage quietly through the compartment's cabinets until she located a modest collection of men's clothing in a trunk. She donned the shirt and the pants, found that they hung off of her like a small tent, and spent the next few moments rolling up the sleeves and legs. Then she donned her gauntlet and felt somewhat better when the cool presence of its weapons crystal rested against her palm. She looked down at herself when finished, and felt certain that Mother would be entirely scandalized by her appearance. It would do. Gwen left the cabin quietly to find her cousin. Benedict would mock her outfit, too, but he'd know what was going on. She opened the door and stepped into mist-shrouded late afternoon daylight. Afternoon? How long had she been asleep? Her last memories trailed off around 8 o'clock the previous evening, and she found that gaping blank space in her mind unnerving. Even eerier, the deck of Predator was utterly empty.
Hello?
Gwen called. There was no answer. She frowned and began pacing the length of the ship. No one in the masts. No one in the galley or the kitchen. No one in any of the passenger cabins, and the door to the captain's cabin was locked. Gwen rubbed wearily at her eyes, and it was just then that she heard a man's voice bawling vile curses, muffled by the planks of the deck. Gwen moved over to the hatch leading below decks, and the curses grew clearer and louder. She followed them, and in short order found herself in the engineering room, the beating heart of Predator, where the air hummed with the steady drone of an active power core crystal. For a second, she thought that the room's floor was littered with corpses, but after a moment she saw that it was covered with exhausted men who had simply stretched out on the floor and gone to sleep. Several were snoring, though that sound was being drowned out by the invective of the one man still on his feet. He was stocky and bald, and sported an enormous bristling moustache. His coveralls were stained with sweat and grease, and though he wasn't particularly tall, his hands looked strong enough to crush crystals in his fingers. He was crouched in front of the adjustable hemisphere of curled copper bars known as a Haslett cage, and he was working ferociously on an awkwardly placed bolt that secured one of the bars in place. The angle was bad for the wrench, but his stump-like forearms couldn't slip through the bars of the cage very easily, and he was having trouble wrangling the tool into position. Gwen stepped over a sleeping man and said,
"Excuse me, sir."
"What?" snarled the bald man, without looking up from his task.
"I'm looking for Sir Benedict Sorrelin. I was wondering if you'd seen him."
The man grunted.
"He in here?"
Gwen looked around the room at the sleeping men.
Definitely not."
"Same answer,"
the man growled. The wrench slipped as he began to apply pressure, and he wound up gouging his hand on the frame.
"Curse you for a whore," he shouted. "Bloody strumpet! You'll be the death of me."
Gwen blinked several times.
"Excuse me, sir? What did you say to me?"
"I wasn't talking to you,"
the man bellowed, going red all the way across his bald pate.
"I was talking to the bloody ship."
He shot a look over his shoulder and froze there, his mouth open for a moment. Then he scowled, turned back to the Haslett cage, and began trying to squeeze his arm inside to grab the wrench he'd dropped.
"Fantastic. Like I don't have enough to do already. Now I have to deal with aristobrats, too. Captain hates me. That's what it is. You can't go fight Journeyman. You have to stay on the ship and fix her up enough for me to ruin Journeyman. God in heaven, the man hates me."
"Ah, the ship's chief etheric engineer, Journeyman." She'd heard his name mentioned when the ship was docking. Well, chief engineer or no, Gwen felt as if she should have been pinning the man's ears back, but her head hurt horribly. She really didn't feel like smashing it against any more metaphorical walls, or literal ones.
"Sir, I'll be glad to leave you to your work. If you could please direct me to the captain, I'll get out of your hair."
The man's eyes whipped around to her, narrowing.
"My what?"
"Lair," Gwen said quickly. "I said I'd get out of your lair."
The man scowled again and went back to reaching for the wrench.
Captain's gone. Doc's gone. Every deckhand still on his feet is gone. It's just my crew and these hired slackers left. And Tarky. But Tarky's barely able to hobble along. Guess that means your Benedict is gone too.
Gone where?
Motherless, horse-spawned, mist-sharking tunnel rat!
Journeyman snarled, jerking his hand free.
Oh, for God's sake!
Gwen sighed. She stepped over to the cage and, before the engineer could object, slipped her slender arm easily between the bars, plucked up the wrench, and drew it back out again. She flipped it in her hand and offered it to him handle first. Journeyman eyed her, moustache bristling. Then he snatched the wrench and said,
"You shouldn't play with the ship's systems. If you'd brushed your hand against the wrong arc, you'd have gotten the shock of your life."
"That's why I didn't touch any of the active arcs,"
Gwen replied calmly.
"You're only running power from the topmost bars at the moment, are you not?"
Journeyman's eyebrows lowered, then rose.
You think you know something about ships, do you?"
"I know little about airships," Gwen replied. "I do possess some small knowledge of their systems."
"Sure you do,"
the man said. Gwen arched an eyebrow.
"I know the topmost left sidebar is out of alignment by at least 2 degrees. You're losing efficiency from it, probably why the air is so warm in here."
The engineer squinted.
"And why do you think you know that?"
"The tone," Gwen said. "There's a bit of a burr in it on that side."
"Huh?"
the man said. He pursed his lips and looked at her speculatively. Then he rose, grabbed the room's 8-foot-high scaffold and slid it into place over the power core. He climbed up on it and thumped around with the Haslett cage for a bit. Then he climbed back down again.
"All better."
Gwen tilted her head to one side and listened to the hum of the power crystal.
"No," she said. "You didn't fix it. You put it out of alignment by at least another 2 degrees.
The engineer must have grinned for an instant, though the moustache camouflaged it. He grunted, went back up the scaffold and thumped around a bit more.
"How's that?"
"That's done it,"
Gwen replied. Journeyman hopped back down from the scaffold, eyed her up and down for a second, and then flipped the wrench over in his hand and offered her the handle. Gwen arched a brow and took it.
"And what am I to do with this?"
"Saw which bolt I was working on, did you?"
"Yes."
"So loosen it," he said. "If you can."
Gwen bounced the wrench lightly in her hand. If Captain Grimm and Benedict were gone with the men, they must have been heading to a fight, but she didn't know where, and doubted her ability to run to catch up with them in her present condition. If she had to simply sit and wait for them to return, she might go mad. She nodded, turned to the Haslett cage, and had the bolt loosened within seconds. Not because she was an expert so much as because she had smaller arms and hands and could work them into the available space much more easily than the engineer could.
"Right," Journeyman said when she was done. "Back."
She drew back and Journeyman threw the release on the lower array. The bottom half of the cage's bars began to swing out, opening away from the crystal within the apparatus, like some kind of gleaming copper flower. Pale green light flooded the chamber, glowing out of the depths of Predator's power core. Gwen stared at the rich green crystal for a second. It didn't have the proper jewel-faceted shape. It was instead formed into a much more natural-looking crystal, like a shaft of glowing emerald quartz. And then her eyes widened as she realized what she was looking at.
"God in heaven," she said.
"Uh-huh,"
Journeyman replied. His tone was unmistakably smug.
"That's a first-generation power core,"
Gwen breathed.
"Before they started developing facets. How old is it?"
"Few thousand years, at least,"
Journeyman said.
if it's that old.
Gwen shook her head. Unlike lumen crystals, or weapons crystals, or cannon crystals, or lift crystals, power crystals only grew more and more capable of efficiently channeling etheric energy. A crystal was rarely considered to be working in its prime before a century of use had worn it into better condition. If the crystal was as old as Journeyman claimed, it would be able to produce more electricity from less etheric energy than almost any crystal Gwen had heard of, which would mean that the ship could sail to more places, farther and farther from the main etheric currents, and do it more swiftly.
That is a tremendously efficient core, Gwen said. It should be in a fleet ship.
Well, she ain't, Journeyman said, and she ain't going to be. She's Preddy's, and that's that.
Incredible, Gwen said, shaking her head.
Journeyman's chest swelled.
Ain't she?
He squinted at her.
Where's a little thing like you learn about ship systems?
From my mother.
Who's your mother?
Helen Lancaster.
Journeyman frowned for a moment, then he blinked.
Lancaster? Lancaster, Lancaster, you mean? The Vattery?
I've been learning about our products since I was old enough to speak, Gwen said, including running system benchmarks on every crystal before we send it out, which means knowing how the systems work.
Those Lancasters,
Journeyman grunted.
Damn.
He seemed to come to a decision and nodded once.
I'm going to start kicking these pansies awake in a bit. You want to be useful meanwhile? Captain got us a little bit of a lift crystal to replace our old one. The trim crystals are all in, but I still have to rig the main one. Could use someone with a good ear for that.
Which crystal? Gwen asked.
One of your new Mark IV Ds.
Gwen blinked at him once.
You misunderstand me, sir. I mean which crystal? Which one of the Mark IV Ds?
Journeyman's mouth spread into a more recognizable grin this time. He nodded to the far end of the chamber toward the ship's suspension rig.
You tell me.
Gwen went down to the rig to regard the crystal and whistled.
This is the one from the vat in Section 3, Row 2. It's one of the best of the batch. God in heaven, if you aren't cautious, with that power core behind it, this crystal could tear the ship apart.
Tell me something I don't know,
Journeyman said.
Which configuration are you planning for its cage?
Standard dispersal, maximum spacing,
Journeyman replied.
What? Gwen asked. Why would you do that?
How else should I do it?
Journeyman snapped.
Didn't you read the owner's manual?
Manual? See here, missy. I've been an etheric engineer since before you were born. I think I know how to handle a lift crystal.
Evidently you aren't bright enough to do so if you cannot read. We provide those manuals and specifications and procedures for a reason, you know.
Journeyman scowled.
You do everything by the book, like everybody else, you get the same results as everybody else.
That's the idea,
Gwen said in a dry tone. Journeyman seemed to miss it.
That might be good enough for every other ship in the world, missy, he said. But that ain't good enough for Preddy. I get 10 to 15% more out of her systems doing it my way.
What? Gwen said. That isn't possible.
Maybe not in your workshops, Journeyman said firmly. But a ship in the open sky is different. You got to know how to treat her the way she likes.
Well, take it from me. She's not going to like that dispersal pattern, Gwen said. The bottom hemisphere of the Mark IV Ds is rigged with variable sensitivity. The closer to the positive end you get, the more powerful the crystal's pathways are. You need to set your bars in an asymmetric configuration to maximize sensitivity. If you go with a standard hemisphere, it will be too easy to dump too much current in. Before you know what happened, you'll be watching that crystal fly to the moon while your ship falls, which you would know if you'd read the manual.
Journeyman ground his teeth.
Always improving things that don't need improving, he muttered. Fine. Asymmetric. Show me.
Chapter 50. Spire Albion. Habel Landing. Ventilation tunnels. Someone shook Major Espira awake, and he blinked his eyes open to find Ciriaco standing over him, his weathered face set.
Sir, that woman's here.
Espira grunted and rose. He wasn't sure how much sleep he'd gotten, but it wasn't much, and it included dreams he planned not to remember. He climbed to his feet from his bedroll, stiff from the cold spirestone floor.
"Better ready the men," he told the sergeant.
"Yes, sir,"
Ciriaco said, and stalked off to do so. The warrior-born man's arm, though still badly burned, was no longer held at an awkward angle, and as he moved away, it swung naturally. Espira found himself wishing for a moment that his own family had carried some measure of warrior-born bloodlines. If he'd been born like Ciriaco, his back wouldn't be so uncomfortable right now.
Of course, if he'd been born like Ciriaco, he wouldn't be a major in the Auroran Marines either.
Espira tugged on his jacket, straightened himself, and strode out of the private little side corridor he occupied in his position as the commanding officer. As he appeared, the men were already rising and gathering their weaponry and gear. Cavendish and her pet monster were nearby, waiting. There was something tight and hard around the woman's eyes. Sark looked as he always did, but Espira had worked with the warrior-born long enough to realize that the slight dilation to the pupils of Sark's crooked eyes meant that he was tense and ready for battle. He'd been hoping for blithe, arrogant confidence from Cavendish. Whatever business she had done with the Albions, it hadn't gone precisely to her schedule. Whatever leverage she thought the hostages had given her must not have been enough. Espira gritted his teeth for an instant, then forced his jaw to relax. The lives of the two young women were worth a little less than nothing if Cavendish decided they had no value to her. And while he had no particular cause to dislike either of the young women, and would prefer to leave them bound and in place to be found later, he still would cut the ladies' throats himself, rather than leave them in the hands of Cavendish or Sark.
"Madame Cavendish," Espira said, bowing politely.
"Major,"
Cavendish said,
"I believe the time has come for us to act."
Espira arched an eyebrow.
"You think we should begin early?"
"I will signal the armada, Major,"
Cavendish said, a frosty edge to her tone. The miracle of such rapid communication was all very well, Espira thought, but it wouldn't make an airship move any faster if it wasn't already in position.
"If I may inquire as to why you believe precipitous action is required, madame."
"I misjudged the man,"
Cavendish said.
"The same commander who defeated your men at the Lancaster Vattery."
"He's here?" Espira demanded. "And you did not see fit to tell us this fact?"
"He's one of their fleet washouts with a crew of privateers,"
Cavendish said.
"They aren't professional soldiers, and their numbers have been significantly reduced. But they can make a great deal of noise before your men wipe them out, and they might sap some of your strength."
"Where are they?"
"Judging by Captain Grimm's confidence,
they are coming here,"
Cavendish replied.
"Strike the primary and secondary targets and make for the extraction point. I want your men gone by the time they arrive."
"And leave a large mobile force at large behind us?" Espira asked.
"I will attend to them," Cavendish said. "They won't be able to pursue." "Where are the prisoners?"
Espira hesitated.
"Major,"
Cavendish said between clenched teeth.
"The hallway we blocked off," Ispira said finally. He nodded down the proper tunnel. Down there. What do you intend for them?
The same as I intend for the rest of the Spyrarch's merry band,
Cavendish said, looking away, her eyes lit with some bizarre emotion Ispira could not identify.
Take your men and go, Major. If you value their lives, none of them will be standing in these tunnels 5 minutes from now.
Ispira frowned at the woman, but she did not return her gaze to his. And then he nodded, bowed again, and withdrew. Ciriaco fell into step beside him. The grizzled sergeant glowered back over his wounded shoulder at Sark for a moment, then turned to Ispira.
We're going early.
Yes. Dispatch the men as planned, immediately. Without the confusion of a general attack on the spire, we'll have to move fast. Tell them to leave all camp equipment and supplies here, except for a canteen. Weapons only. Ciriaco frowned, but nodded.
Those two girls?
Rinaldo Ispira had done a great many distasteful, necessary things in the course of his career. The orders of his superiors were generally given to him with the aim of benefiting those same superiors in some way. He was under no illusion about that. But even so, there was, somewhere within him, enough conscience to at least feel shame about it. He felt ashamed of the next words he spoke to the sergeant.
They're as good as dead. And no longer our concern, sergeant,
he said quietly. Ciriaco glanced at the corridor where the prisoners were being kept and clenched his large hands into fists with an audible crack of knuckles. He exhaled at once.
Sir, he said,
world might be a brighter place without Sark and that woman in it.
Creating a brighter world is not our concern or duty, sergeant, Ispira said without heat. From this moment, all that we need concern ourselves with is accomplishing our objectives and getting as many Marines as possible out of this madness and back home to Spire Aurora alive and well. Clear? Ciriaco made a growling sound deep in his chest, but his hands relaxed and he nodded once.
Clear, sir.
He looked down at Ispira.
Think we can pull this off?
Of course. Ispira replied with a confidence he was not at all sure he felt. If each man remembers his duty and his training.
And doesn't stand around wondering why we're doing it,
Ciriaco said. Ours is not to reason why, sergeant, Ispira said. Tell the captain of each force to move out. I want every single man of my command out of these tunnels in 3 minutes.
Chapter 51 Spire Albion, Havel Landing, Ventilation Tunnels.
It's just not natural, growled Felix to Grimm. That's all I'm saying.
Grimm regarded askance the Verminositor walking on his left.
You can only give me a general idea of which section of tunnels your missing man had entered.
He gestured to the small, utterly black cat who paced calmly a few steps ahead of Grimm.
It would seem that our companion has a more specific idea. Like as not the little beast is leading us into a trap,
Felix predicted.
I certainly hope so. I'd like to think that we haven't brought all these weapons for nothing,
Grimm said. Grimm's crew walked behind him in a tight, purposeful group alongside the Verminositors' Guild of Havel Landing. The Verminositors were a hard-bitten, wiry bunch. Very few of them were of even middling stature, or heavy of build, but they were, men and women alike, made of rope and gristle, and they all bore scars as mute testimony of dangers faced and overcome in the past.
You say the cat belongs to a guardsman?
Felix continued.
This one, no, Grimm said, but I dare say our guide is acquainted with Raoul. At the mention of the name, the little cat looked back at them without slowing her pace, focusing her lambent green eyes on Grimm.
He lifted his hand and signaled a halt, and the men clattered to a stop.
"This is as good a place as any to stop and get more information," Grimm said. "I take it that is correct, Miss Cat."
The cat stopped in her tracks and turned to face Grimm. She regarded Felix for a moment, interested, then looked back up at Grimm. She moved her head up and down in a slow, deliberate nod.
"He sent you to fetch us?" Grimm asked.
Again the cat nodded.
"Good," Grimm said. "Do you know exactly where the girls are being held?"
She nodded again, and after a moment she shook her head left and right.
"There," Felix said. "Now what's that supposed to mean?"
Grimm gave him a mild look.
"Apparently that I need to learn to speak cat."
He frowned and called,
"Benedict, can you understand them at all?"
The tall young warrior born shook his head.
"Barely more than a greeting and a few pleasantries. It's a complex language and takes years to learn."
At this, the little black cat looked pleased.
"Bother," Grimm said. "If we go storming in and start shooting up the place when we stumble over the enemy, we're as likely to shoot the girls in the confusion as we are the foe. I need more specific information. She obviously knows it, or knows it better than we do, at least."
Felix huffed out a thoughtful breath. Then he reached into his coat and withdrew a thick folded sheaf of paper. He began to unfold it and laid it out on the floor. Grimm peered at it. It was a map of Habel Landing, with ventilation and service tunnels marked in several different colors, evidently to represent their respective elevations.
"Here, beastie," Felix said. "Have a look at this."
He tapped a portion of the map with a thick forefinger.
"I know Moberly was working in this general section of the tunnels. Which one have the Aurorans taken?"
The cat prowled over to the map and regarded it with bright eyes. She tilted her head this way and that, pawed at its surface, sniffed it, walked over it, then sat down and just stared at Felix.
"What the bloody hell is that supposed to mean?"
Felix demanded of Grimm.
"It's too abstract," Benedict said. "Maps are symbols, and she doesn't have the necessary experience she needs to understand one."
"Explain, please," Grimm asked.
Benedict moved a hand in a small, frustrated gesture.
"She doesn't experience the tunnels the way you do. She doesn't just see the tunnels. She navigates them by smell and sound as much as by sight. Show her a picture that is a symbolic representation of visual dimensions alone, and it's confusing to her."
Felix shook his head.
"How do you know that?"
"Because it was confusing as hell to me when I was learning to read maps," Benedict replied. "It took me a while when I was young."
Felix growled.
"How hard is it to read a bloody map?"
Grimm pursed his lips and regarded the cat thoughtfully.
"Perhaps we don't need her to read a map for us," he mused.
"Perhaps we need her to draw one."
"What?" Felix asked. "I need a piece of chalk," Grimm said, and raised his voice. "Who has some?"
"Skip!"
called Stern. The little man hefted his long gun onto his shoulder, dug in his pocket, and came out with a lump of chalk, which he tossed to Grimm underhand. Grimm caught it and turned to the cat.
"Miss Cat," he said, "if you're willing, perhaps we can work out exactly where we're going so that we can take the most appropriate steps to deal with the situation."
The cat regarded him intently and then nodded once.
"Thank you," Grimm said. "I propose to have you pace out the length of the tunnels in question relative to one another. Not at full length, of course. Perhaps one pace to every 30 you would take were you actually walking through them. I will follow you with the chalk and sketch the tunnels you show me on the floor."
Felix grunted.
"Then we compare the sketch to the map."
"Precisely," Grimm said.
The cat seemed to consider the idea for a moment, then rose and turned away from Grimm with an impatient little mrowl. She began walking, her head tilted at a bit of an angle, and Grimm followed her,
marking the spire stone floor with chalk. The little cat walked for several moments, and Grimm followed her, hoping that he didn't look quite as preposterous as he felt, following the creature around on his hands and knees until she turned to face him and sat down once more. He rose, his wounded arm aching, and regarded the chalk lines.
"Well, Felix?"
The Verminositor lifted his map and peered at it, and then at the drawings on the floor.
"I don't think that... No. Wait a moment. This section, here. By God in heaven, look, it lines up well enough. She must have walked all around their perimeter. They're here, in the middle."
Grimm regarded the portion of the map soberly.
"Four ways in, four ways out."
"Meow,"
said the black cat, and shook her head. Grimm arched an eyebrow and eyed her.
"Less?"
She nodded.
"They've blockaded tunnels."
She nodded again. "Which, please?" Grimm asked. The cat paced over to an intersection of chalk lines and pawed at the floor, then at another.
"This one and this one," Grimm said, thumping a finger on the map. "They cut down the approach to two tunnels and left themselves two ways out." "Your men take one," Felix suggested. "We'll take the other."
Grimm looked up and arched an eyebrow.
"Down tunnels they've prepared to defend. We'd pay a heavy price and never get to the prisoners before they were killed." "What then?" Felix demanded. "Their only chance is for us to get in fast and hard, find the prisoners and get out again before the enemy can react properly. We need to go in from a direction they do not expect."
He pursed his lips.
"Coin toss may be the best we can hope for." "Mr. Stern."
"I skip."
The lean young officer came forward.
"I trust that you brought the blasting charges we acquired from the Aurorans in Habel Morning."
Stern gave Grimm a wide, hungry grin. Chapter 52. Spire Albion, Habel Landing, Ventilation Tunnels. Odd clicking sounds made Bridget lift her head and open her eyes. She and Folly had decided to resume their original positions in the event that their captors peeked in at them. The leather cords were looped loosely around their wrists, though Bridget had been unable to devise a way to wrap their ankles in a similar fashion, one that could be shed immediately, and they'd had to simply settle for hiding their feet within their skirts. Time passed, and not quickly. With every breath and heartbeat, Bridget imagined their captors, out of sight, deciding that this was the moment in which to murder them. The sounds came again. Rapid, irregular clicks, somehow familiar, from the enemy camp.
"I
wonder what that is,"
Folly whispered.
"Something's happening,"
Bridget murmured back. She rose and paced as silently as she could to the tarp, blocking their view of the tunnel outside. She eased up to a slight gap in its edge and peeked through it as quickly as she could. A single glance froze her with sheer terror.
Silk weavers.
Dozens and dozens of adult silk weavers with leathery, armored bodies and torsos the size of Bridget's own. The beasts must have weighed at least what she did, and yet they moved with that same horrible alien grace as their broodlings had. They were flowing into the Auroran camp along the floor, the walls, and the ceiling of the ventilation tunnels, visible in the light of half a dozen small lumen crystals that had evidently been left behind by the departing troops. Bridget blinked and took a longer look. Everywhere she saw empty bedrolls, discarded backpacks, litter, and trash, and no Aurorans anywhere. They had abandoned their camp, and now the silk weavers were taking their place. Bridget wanted to turn and run, but she forced herself to stay still, to look, to see. She couldn't see much of the area, not enough to get an estimate of how many Aurorans had been there.
The silk weavers prowled restlessly, and she couldn't be sure how many there were. 40 or 50, perhaps? And there, next to a bedroll that had been neatly folded, rolled, and tied, she saw her gauntlet, her knife, and Folly's expended lumen crystals still in their two little bags and glass jar. Bridget took slow steps back, being as quiet as she possibly could. She turned to find Folly staring at her, her face pale, her mismatched eyes very wide. Bridget crouched down next to Folly and whispered into her ear,
"Adult silk weavers, dozens of them."
Folly started trembling, but nodded her head once.
"Don't worry,"
she whispered to her little crystal.
"I'll protect you." "I found your crystals,"
Bridget whispered. Folly's head snapped up, her eyes wide. She pressed her single little crystal to her lips.
"Oh,"
she whispered,
"I do hope they're all right."
"They're only about 10 feet away," Bridget said. "My gauntlet is there, too.
I think I can get to them. If I can get you the crystals..."
"Yes," Folly interrupted, nodding, her eyes closed.
"Yes, that."
"If I can," Bridget said, "can you do anything to get us out of here?" Folly licked her lips. Then she took a slow, deep breath and let it out. Then another, and another. When she opened her eyes, they were glazed, their pupils dilated enormously. She turned her gaze slowly, left to right, then shivered and bowed her head.
"There are no currents in here,"
she whispered to her crystal.
"But there's another blocked hole to the left. There's a conduit there. I could use that."
"How far?" Folly shook her head.
50 feet, I think. Though it's a silly way to measure. Steps would be more practical. Or strides. Yes, strides."
Bridget chewed on her lip. 40 or 50 silk weavers. 10 feet to the equipment. 50 feet to the other hallway. They'd never make that without being seen. She felt certain that in a drama, a heroine would have immediately devised a plan to sacrifice herself boldly for her companion. She'd rush out into the hall and fling the crystals back to Folly, and then run in the opposite direction, screaming and drawing all the silk weavers after her. She would put up a bold fight, but ultimately die gallantly while Folly brought terrible retribution upon the surface creatures, and then finished the mission, mourning her fallen friend in the aftermath. Heroines in dramas, Bridget felt, really ought to have more sense. The silk weavers hadn't seen them yet, or, if they had sensed their presence, hadn't attacked. If they hadn't done so yet, they might not, at least for a while. The Aurorans certainly were nowhere to be seen. Perhaps the smartest thing to do would be to simply wait quietly. Their best hope, it seemed, was that Raoul would bring aid. They should stand ready to assist in their own rescue when it came. After all, if the silk weavers did decide to eat them, Bridget always had the option of throwing away her own life in a desperate gamble to save Folly's. But until such time as she had no other option, she would avoid that course of action, thank you very much. Bridget felt she would make a terrible dramatic heroine. And then, over the clicking sounds of silk weaver legs and brushing chitin, Bridget heard voices speaking. That sent another thrill of terror down her spine. Humans? Near silk weavers? There was only one real possibility that leapt to mind. These must be the people who were in control of the horrible things. And that was something that the Spireark would want to know all about. Her duty as a guardsman was perfectly clear. She must do everything she could to learn about these individuals.
Oh, dear.
Bridget swallowed and once more stalked quietly up to the gap in the partition. She peeked out, moving as slowly as possible. A man and a woman were walking toward her through the silk weavers,
as if the creatures were nothing more out of place or threatening than a crowd of school children busily playing during a recess. She was dressed impeccably, in a dress and jacket of grey and lavender cloth, her hair done up with pristine neatness at the nape of her neck, and sporting a matching hat and white gloves. She was a mature woman, with empty grey eyes, and a kind of severe, hard-edged beauty. A scarlet stone glittered at her throat, worn next to her skin on a black velvet choker. The man walking beside her was warrior-born, like Benedict. He was taller, though, and carried more muscle on his long frame. Short hairs, dull brown, sprinkled with silver, adorned his head in a sparse fuzz, matched along his arms and neck and face, giving him an especially feral appearance. One of his feline eyes was off-center, and there was something about the way he moved that was just wrong. Benedict did not walk so much as glide with flowing grace evident in every gesture and motion. This man, it took Bridget a moment to register it, this man moved with the grace of a silk weaver.
"Still don't see what all the fuss is about," the man said. "A fire would do. One person, in and out."
"You underestimate the Waists," the woman said. "There are warrior born among their number too."
Her dark eyes glittered.
"Besides, a fire is not enough. A message must be sent."
The man grunted.
"Seems foolish."
"We'll never destroy them while they remain in heaven. We must, therefore, draw them out."
Bridget blinked at that.
"Baiting the mist shark," the man said. "Sometimes that doesn't go the way you think."
"Risks must be taken in war," the woman said calmly. "In fact..."
Her voice trailed off suddenly, and her eyes became unfocused, abstracted, in a manner eerily akin to Folly's a few moments before. The gem at her throat flickered with deep scarlet light.
"Ah,"
the woman said, her tone pleased.
"My sentries. They are here. I thought as much."
The man inhaled and rolled his shoulders. He drew a short, wide sword into his hand, and the gauntlet on the other kindled to life.
"Where?"
"Groups are moving toward both tunnels in,"
the woman said.
"No more than 20 each."
She moved her hand in an imperious gesture, and once more the gem at her throat flickered with sullen fire. The reaction of the silk weavers was immediate. They began to rush into two distinct groups, forming in tight ranks. The first group piled up at the mouth of a tunnel, the other rushed out of sight of where Bridget could see, but she presumed they had formed up at another tunnel mouth.
"You want any of them alive?"
the man asked.
"Unnecessary,"
she replied.
"Sark, kill the prisoners. I'd hate for the captain to think I wasn't true to my word."
The man, Sark, turned on his heel at once and strode purposefully toward the partition. Bridget never really thought about what she did next. If she had, she would have found the idea ludicrously terrifying. She burst through the concealing partition and into a silent run in the open, in full view of a warrior born with a primed gauntlet. Everything seemed to slow down, and Bridget had time to note, idly, that Raoul had probably saved her life again. When other children had been playing hide-and-seek with one another, Bridget had been playing it with Raoul. She did not move with the utter silence of a cat, but she couldn't really think of any other humans who could do better than she could. Had she made the faintest sound before she moved, the softest scrape of a boot on stone, the least careless rustle of fabric, Sark's warrior-born senses would have pinpointed her exact location.
The man may well have been able to target her even concealed by the partition. But she hadn't made any mistakes. She had, Raoul would have said, behaved with acceptable competence. Sark had been taken entirely off guard. She gained no more than a heartbeat or two of shock, time enough to reach the little pile of equipment. Then the man's reflexes took over, and he raised his gauntlet, sighting on her between the V made of his parted fingers. It was time enough for Bridget to seize the glass jar of crystals and throw it back toward Folly. She whirled to one side and flung herself flat on the ground, only to see Sark calmly track her motion, rather than shooting hastily. He lined up his shot, neither rushed nor slow, and the crystal against his palm brightened. Bridget did not face her death bravely. She screamed with pure fear, lifting a hand. The gauntlet flashed. A tiny star tumbled into the path of the etheric bolt, intercepted it, and sent the shot curving out in a wide arc that circled around Bridget entirely. Bridget stared in bewilderment, stunned at how slowly it all seemed to happen. The bolt wrapped around her and splashed onto the floor beyond the partition, directly into the scatter of broken glass and loose lumen crystals that marked where Bridget's throw had fallen well short of Folly. The force of the blast did not scatter the crystals, as Bridget's common sense told her it absolutely should have. Instead, it just seemed to disperse, spreading out like a wave. Where the wave spread, the little crystals burst into hot, angry light. And abruptly, all at once, they rose into the air in a cloud of glowing motes. Folly appeared among them, striding forward, flickers of light dancing along her candy-striped hair, her mismatched eyes blazing. Sark loosed several more blasts, all of which dispersed into the crystals, making them glow with even brighter light. Folly's voice rang out, cold and hard.
"We don't like it when people try to hurt our friends."
And the entire cloud of crystals flew at Sark like bullets loosed from a gun. Sark dropped to one knee, flinging both arms up over his head. The cloud of glowing crystals tore into his flesh with a sickening, rippling sound. A fine spray of blood erupted from countless wounds. Crystals lodged in him like hundreds of tiny darts, glowing where they erupted from his skin. A shuddering breath escaped the warrior-born. And then he heaved himself to his feet, lowering his arms. They burned with scarlet light as droplets of blood covered the crystals. They protruded from his arms, his belly, one shin, one thigh. He bled and glowed with the power the etherealist's apprentice had loosed upon him. His ugly features showed not a trace of pain or fear. He flexed his hand, and the light from the gauntlet's crystal died away.
"Really?"
asked the woman, something like a laugh bubbling in the word. Bridget looked up to see that she was watching with what appeared to be high amusement as she spoke to Folly.
"How many years have you been his apprentice? And he's only taught you transference and kinetics."
She regarded Sark for a moment, then looked back to Folly.
"Tell me that's not the entire extent of your ability."
Folly stared back at the woman. Her mouth opened, then closed again. The blood drained from her face. The woman bent and plucked up the little bags of lumen crystals, which Bridget had not had time to throw. She tossed them to Folly. The bags landed at her feet and burst, the crystals scattering.
"It isn't polite for peers to murder one another without introduction,"
the woman said.
"And while you are not my equal, you do have talent."
She inclined her head.
"My name is Sycorax Cavendish. Like you, I was once apprenticed to Master Etherealist Epherus Ephrenus Ferus. And then he betrayed me."
She smiled and flexed her fingers.
"And you are?"
Folly swallowed. She looked down at the little crystals, fingers twitching as though she had to restrain herself from stooping to pick them up. Then she bobbed a quick curtsy, her eyes on her crystals, and said,
"My name is Folly, ma'am."
Cavendish burst into a merry laugh.
"Folly, is it? Did he give you this name?"
"And much more than that,"
Folly said. Then her eyes widened, and she looked up.
"Oh,
it's you. You're the gnat I caught."
Cavendish seemed somewhat taken aback by the comment, and arched an eyebrow.
"Excuse me? You were buzzing and buzzing, so I built a web to catch you. It wasn't a very pretty web, but I did."
Folly tilted her head.
You were receiving orders."
She chewed on her lip for a moment.
"You have a new master now. Is that it?"
Cavendish's eyes narrowed.
"There's nothing wrong with your mind, I suppose, Miss Folly."
Her teeth showed.
"Yet. Shall I show you what real power feels like?"
"I don't talk to puppets,"
Folly said.
"They can't talk back. Not really. They just dance on their strings."
Cavendish's eyes flashed.
"Sark,"
she said,
"kill the other one."
Sark pivoted toward Bridget and started walking forward, sword in hand. Cavendish flicked a finger at Folly. Folly's eyes flew open wide, and pure agony flowed from her mouth in a scream that seemed to have been ripped loose from her guts and tore up her gullet. Bridget rolled to her feet, for all the good it would do her against an armed warrior-born. And then there was a horrible slap against her body, and with a roar of sound and smoke, the entire world flew sideways. Chapter 53. Spire Albion, Habel Landing, Ventilation Tunnels. The blasting charges blew a wide hole in the mound of broken masonry that had been used to plug the tunnel. The sound of the explosion was an invisible wall that swept through the corridor, sucking the wind from Grimm's lungs despite his protected position around the nearest corner. Grimm forced himself to stagger out into the tunnel before he'd managed to draw a breath. He was running toward the breach in the masonry barricade before the flying bits of stone had stopped rattling to the floor, sword in hand and gauntlet primed, and he heard the clatter of boots behind him as Kettle sent the men running in his wake. The air was thick with dust and stinking sulphurous smoke. Bits of stone of various sizes twisted beneath his boots, threatening his balance, and his imagination treated him to an image of himself sprinting straight into a wall in the bad visibility and stabbing himself with his own sword. God in heaven knew, if he'd chosen the wrong tunnel, the one where the Cavendish woman had been keeping her prisoners, he'd deserve it. The direction of his thoughts distracted him, and he nearly stumbled over a block of masonry the size of a slab of fresh meat. A hand with a grip like copper-clad steel locked onto his upper arm, and Sir Benedict helped him keep his balance and continue moving forward. The young warrior-born was tense, his feline eyes bright, and Grimm knew that they were lucky to have such a resource entering the battle with them. Grimm plunged out of the dark and smoke into an area lit with scattered lumen crystals. The dust and grit in the air gave everything an odd, flat quality, as if his depth perception had suddenly been blurred. The occupants of the chamber were still reeling, stunned by the explosion and flying debris, and Grimm had what seemed an eternity to take it all in. Miss Targwyn was down, lying sprawled on the floor as if she had been struck a stunning blow, her wide eyes unfocused. Not 5 feet away from her lay Sark, the warrior-born who had accompanied Madame Cavendish. The large man was already rolling to regain his feet, and copper-clad steel gleamed in his hand. Several yards beyond Sark, Madame Cavendish had fallen to one knee, her expensive dress and bolero covered in dust.
her teeth were clenched, and she shook her head even as Grim dismissed the priming charge from his gauntlet and drew his pistol into his left hand instead. His mind was still cataloguing details as he strode forward, bringing the pistol to bear. Very few men could afford the expense it took to operate a pistol until they were experts in the weapon.